Well, now let's reflect on all the people who made it possible for us to be here tonight, to enjoy this evening together, to enjoy this incredibly rare privilege in our troubled world of spending an evening to reflect on how best to experience and express love. Think of the staff of the Miracle Distribution Center, all the work they did to set up this evening. Think of Bill Thetford and Helen Schuckman, the fears they had to confront in taking down the course, feeling they were risking their reputation, but wanting to do the task given them. Think of all the people in the Foundation for Inner Peace, Judy Scutch and others, who have devoted their lives to making the course available. Think of all the other people, hundreds of thousands, working with the course, trying as hard as they can to deepen their love for you and everyone else. And the other people who came tonight, making it possible for us to put on this evening and be together. And think of the people who built this building and who paved the roads that we drove on to come here, and who drilled for the oil for our gasoline and grew the food which we ate before coming here. And think of the bounty of the earth. And think of our parents and family. And think of yourself and your dedication to learning and to love, and all the work you've done to face your fears, your difficulties, in order to experience and express love better. And as you reflect, really one comes to recognize that we're all interconnected and all dependent on one another, and that our being here is really dependent on everyone else on the planet. And so we can feel grateful to everyone for this opportunity to be here together. So at any moment then, we have this opportunity to reflect on all we have to be grateful for, and to fill our minds and hearts with gratitude. And as the Course says, love cannot be far behind a grateful heart and thankful mind. So, what one does with gratitude then is that one reorients the mind, our perspective, from fear and recrimination to appreciation. And there's a spectrum of perspectives. And what we're doing is trying to move ourselves along the spectrum. At one end, there's paranoia, which you think that everyone's against you. A little over, there's indifference, in which you think that kind of the universe is indifferent to our well-being. Then there's pronoia, in which you think that everyone's for you. And then there's metanoia, in which you see the entire universe as one vast conspiracy to wake you up. And gratitude helps us shift from paranoia towards pronoia and metanoia. And then finally there's the arousing of love itself. The specific working on this particular emotion. And a range of techniques, the Course is full of them. Again, reflecting, thinking about loving people or memories, for example. A range of meditations, which in general break down into two major classes. One is visualization, in which one visualizes loving memories, loving people, sages, saints, loved ones, and as one visualizes them, then the corresponding experience or emotion of love tends to arise. So that's visualization. The other major category or class of meditations are recitations, in which one repeats a phrase, kind of almost like a mantra, except it's a meaningful phrase. And all of us who've worked with the Course know the power of some of the Course's phrase, "I feel the love of God within me now." You know, you recite that throughout the day, and those are the feelings which tend to arise. So I think you can see from this that the Course is very much aligned with the world's great spiritual traditions in providing a superb vision of love and its potency and its power and the extent to which it is one with our true nature and who and what we really are. And also in laying out a variety of practices, both general and specific, for fostering our psychological spiritual maturation and for cultivating positive mental qualities, culminating in this experience, recognition, and expression of love. And the result is this metta, this agape, this bhakti, which is not less dependent on the whims of others and based on this sense, recognition of who and what we really are, and that we are not lacking, we're not deficient. That's unconditional, inclusive, and unitive, which recognizes our unity, our oneness. And with this recognition at its most profound, the Course and variety of other traditions would say, we awaken. We come to recognize our true nature, and we recognize that that true nature is the same as the nature in each and every other person and in the divine, and that we are not separate from either. But even this recognition is not the end. There's yet one more stage in the spiritual path. For the person who has cultivated love, who has recognized their own sufficiency, who no longer feels driven by fear and guilt and anger, but rather experiences love and joy and compassion, with their own suffering now reduced, they become more and more sensitive to the pain and suffering outside them and are increasingly drawn towards the extension of their own love and the alleviation of the pain of others. It's sometimes thought that the spiritual path consists solely of withdrawal, perhaps into a monastery or a cave. But this is to confuse a part of the path and mistake it for the whole. Because when one looks at the great spiritual traditions, one finds that there is actually a cycle to spiritual practice, in which at times one is drawn to quietness, to solitude, to go in as deeply as possible, and other times pulled out into the world. And that the deeper one goes into oneself, and the more one alleviates one's own pain, the more one is drawn out into the world to alleviate the pain of others. Joseph Campbell called this the hero's return. And Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, found in his survey of world history that there was one characteristic that was common to the lives of those people who had contributed most to human development. And that was what he called the cycle of withdrawal and return. The truly great figures of human history, at some stage in their life, went through a period in which they withdrew from normal interaction, went as deeply into themselves as they possibly could to wrestle with the fundamental questions of existence, plumbed their own depths, found the answers that they sought, and then returned to the world to share their wisdom with the world, returned to help, to heal, and to teach. And for this cycle of withdrawal and return, there are numerous metaphors in the world's traditions. In Plato, it's the re-entry into the cave. In Zen, it's the 10th ox herding picture. It's the picture which shows this disheveled-looking monk just wandering through the marketplace. And it describes him as being unrecognizable, just looks like an ordinary person, except that he enters the marketplace with help-bestowing hands, so that every action is directed towards helping. In Christianity, it's called the fruitfulness of the soul. The soul which has experienced mystical union has touched and merged with the divine in so-called divine marriage, then re-enters the world to bear fruit in the world, and that fruit is help and healing. So that the person who has truly experienced love is drawn to express it, and that expression takes the form of help and service. And a person who has cultivated love and seeks only to serve becomes a force and inspiration of extraordinary power. Perhaps one of the best examples in our culture is Mother Teresa, the one we know of best, who we've heard of most. Mother Teresa is extraordinary. She's this diminutive little figure who comes up to about here on me. And I wouldn't take her on for anything. That is one of the most powerful women I've ever run across. She works continuous. Unless she's praying, she is working to help. Although she does loaf off and sleep 3 hours each night. And she constantly works, and she wants to help and treats everyone the same. She, for example, will, you know, she, on the numerous travels, she carries this great sack of mail with her, and she hops on a plane, sits in a seat, pulls out letters at random, starts answering. Dear Johnny, thank you very much for your letter. I will pray for you and your friends in sixth grade. Dear Sally, thank you for your letter. I hope you and your little friends are happy. Dear Queen Elizabeth, thank you for your letter. And then when she gets off the plane, she hands the sack to someone and races off to work. And then when I was in India working at her center in Calcutta, I was humbled. I couldn't keep up with these little nuns. I mean, they started in the small hours of the morning praying on a cement floor. After a few minutes, I kind of sidled to the back of the room and leant up against the wall, get off my knees. Then they worked through the day, and I worked the morning, and I was ready to call it quits. And they went on for the rest of the day. I ran across someone who was told of being the in charge of the American food distribution project in India. And at one time he had a trainload of grain sent to, ready to ship off. He said, this tiny little nun walked into my office and said, I need that train of grain. And I thought to myself, lady, you're nuts. He said, you know, for 20 years, I've never been able to figure out why I signed that trainload of grain over to her. You know, the power of love committed to service is one of the most profound forces in our world. For the 40th anniversary of the United Nations, Mother Teresa was invited to address the United Nations. And there's a rule in the United Nations which says no prayer allowed. So Mother Teresa got up on the podium and said, and now we will pray. Can you put the slide on, please? And here's what she said. She said it a little more clearly than that. That's okay. I can read it. What she said was this. You and I must come forward and share the joy of loving. But we can't give what we don't have. That's why we need to pray. And prayer will give us a clean heart. And a clean heart can see God in each other. And if we see God in each other, we'll be able to live in peace. And if we live in peace, we'll be able to share the joy of being with each other. And God will be with us. It's a profound message that if we see our true nature, we see it in all others. And if we see the true nature of others, we see it in ourselves. And we see that not only are we more than we imagined, we're more than we can imagine. And that love is a natural experience and expression of who we truly are. Thank you.
Anyway, so as we find our seats, I wanted to mention, too, that after the question and answer period, Roger is going to have a summary, a closing, and then we're going to have a special dance joining. So this will be a lot of fun, which Marika is going to do. And then at the end, we are going to have a time of autographing. We have some of Roger's books, Staying Alive, The Spirit of Shamanism, and a number of his books from The Course in Miracles. So if you are interested in that, there will be a time to autograph books and to share a little bit more with Roger. Now, without further ado, Dr. Walsh.
Well, I thought that we could begin with just reflecting on a couple of questions that people raised in writing, and then we can engage in some dialogue, and you can have a chance to say something, and we can do that. I wanted to ask for written questions, one, so I could pick out some that I could answer, and secondly, so that I could see if there are any common themes. And perhaps the most common theme really spoke to the question of how do we come to terms with the amount of pain and fear and suffering we see both out in the world and in ourselves. And a question of one of the questions was, how do we deal with the pain of discovering just how unloving we are? And these touch into a very common theme that is really, or seems to rise for everyone on the spiritual path, and taps into one of the major traps, and that is when we start on a path, so often we get a vision of what's possible, a sense of possibility, and then we assume we should be able to get there very easily and automatically. And there's a disquieting sense of pain when we recognize just how much fear and anger we have and how difficult it sometimes seems to let that go. And at this stage, there's often a sense that we've gone backwards, we're losing progress rather than making it. And yet, that's actually the first crucial step. That is recognizing the extent of the problem. And for me, one of the most astounding things about our human existence is that we can live an entire lifetime with our minds outside of our control, being largely unconscious, driven by fear and anger, and not appreciate that fact, and think we're awake and alive and as fully aware as it's possible to be. And what happens when one first begins a spiritual practice is that as the mind gets a little clearer, the defenses let go and one sees the extent of pain both in oneself and outside, and often it's overwhelming. And then the trap is thinking there's something wrong, I've blown it, and I'll never be able to handle this. Instead of recognizing that the appreciation, the recognition, the confrontation with the extent of our dysfunction and of the dysfunction of the world is actually the first crucial step on the path. So then there's a second step, and the second step is very simply one continues a practice. Whatever practice one's drawn to, you continue it, trusting that the recognition of suffering in oneself and others is seeing things is seeing more clearly, and the way out is to continue the process. And then, at a certain stage, there's usually a 180-degree shift that occurs in practice. It's very profound and really shifts the whole idea of what spiritual practice is about. Usually we start off with an idea of what enlightenment or awakening or perfection looks like and set about remolding ourselves into that image. Trouble is, it turns out to be a lot of hard work and slow. Which is why you can understand why the Asians invented reincarnation. You know, it sure looks more than one lifetime's work. But at a certain point, there's a 180-degree shift in which you begin to recognize that the game is not about making oneself perfect, but rather about acceptance as we are. And that our so much of our pain comes from judgment of and non-acceptance of ourselves as we are in this moment. And as the Course emphasizes, as each tradition emphasizes, it's in this moment that we have the possibility of freedom. In this moment, not by virtue of transforming ourselves into a saint, but rather by accepting ourselves as we are. And this is the shift from the paths of attainment, in which we try to make ourselves into something different, to the paths of always already truth, in which we recognize that we always already are acceptable, okay, and within us is the divine. So this seems to be almost a universal part of the whole process, this initial pain at recognizing the extent of suffering and dysfunction, and then a gradual shift from thinking we've got to get rid of it all to appreciating that the task is to accept it. That was the main theme that came out of the questions. There are just a couple of very ones I can answer very briefly, and then let's get into a dialogue. One was, what age do you recommend starting children meditating? The classic answer to that in the traditions is around the age 7. That was the age at which kids were usually described as being able to undertake some simple meditative practices. I don't think there's any data, contemporary data on this, and you know, probably one can best do it as a parent intuitively, but that's the classical answer. The other one, is there any way that you know of to induce an out-of-body experience? Well, dying is a good way. Any books you'd recommend on this? There are several. I'm just reading one actually by one of the people in our audience, Barbara Harris, the Full Circle, right? Which is her account of her own near-death experience and subsequent out-of-body experience. It's a wonderful account of that research. There's a couple books by Robert Munro called Journeys Out of the Body, in which he describes supposed out-of-body experiences. And also keep in mind that there are countless warnings in the various traditions against getting attached to any particular experience. So it's your turn, please. Would anyone like to share or to comment or to question? Everyone is answered complete. Yeah, please.
Well, I'll be cool and add that you mentioned reincarnation, which you elucidate how the Course teaches or doesn't teach about linear reincarnation.
Okay, the question is, what does the Course have to say about reincarnation? The Course has a nice answer in the Manual for Teachers saying that it's not essential to adopt any particular perspective or belief system about this. And in some sense, the whatever belief system is functional for a person is okay. But do keep in mind that, firstly, the idea of the time is an illusion. And so the idea of sequential reincarnation is obviously illusionary. And since the world and body are an illusion, then the idea of incarnation the first time is curious anyway, well, let alone reincarnation. So that's how the Course deals with it. Yeah. Please. Could I describe? Okay, let's see. The question was, how does the Course view forgiveness and how does it compare with other traditions there? Well, first off, the Course has, as I mentioned, the most extensive and complete psychological approach to forgiveness of any tradition I've seen. And I emphasize it's a psychological approach because Whereas, for example, there in Christianity, there is great emphasis on forgiveness, and Jesus gave us perhaps the greatest example of forgiveness that's ever been offered to the world. The view of it is largely theological, religious. The course has the spiritual dimension, but its treatment of forgiveness is much more psychological. It recognizes that what we are actually forgiving in others are those aspects of ourselves which we disown and project onto others and then condemn them for. So what we're unable to accept in ourselves, what the Jungians call the shadow, we project out onto the world, see it out there, attack it, condemn it, and thereby maintain our sense of separation and the whole egoic defense system. So from the Course's perspective then, forgiveness is a powerful strategy for relinquishing condemnation judgment on anything and everything, whether it be internal or apparently external. Inasmuch as the nature of the mind is that the mind, and mind doesn't just stop at the skin encapsulated body, but rather the mind is constantly either extending qualities, such as love, or projecting qualities, such as fear, which we have disowned. Consequently, the practice of forgiveness then extends across the egoic boundary so that what we forgive in others, we are forgiving in ourselves. What we forgive in others, we are able to forgive in what we forgive in others, we forgive in ourselves. What we forgive in ourselves, we forgive in others. So that forgiveness is an all-encompassing practice in which the egoic boundaries and differences are broken down and leads to a relinquishment of anger, of fear, etc. In other words, relinquishes the barriers to the experience and expression of love as our true nature. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, please. Well, thank you. What courses do I teach at the university? I have a wonderful job. It took me a couple of years to figure out how best to make use of being a professor, but I finally got that when you're a student, you take classes to learn things, and as a professor, you teach them to learn things. So basically, I teach whatever I want to learn. And I'm in a very fortunate position of being able to teach a wide range of topics, so I teach everything from philosophy to comparative religion to, we have one group in which Marika's a part of, which we meet on evenings and explore different contemplative practices. This is a University of California seminar, believe it or not. Let's see, what else? Comparative psychotherapy. So I get to play with lots of things, which I love. Thank you.